couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films Wolf, Come On, Come On, Silent Night, 8-Bit Christmas, and Diary of a Wimpy Kid. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park, and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Malignant. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Stephen Sondheim, at age 91, passed away in his home on November 26. Of course, Sondheim is well remembered for creating some just epic musicals, everything from Gypsy to Sweeney Todd to Sunday in the Park with George and Into the Woods, and especially with West Side Story coming out this month with Steven Spielberg's reimagining of it. It's already high profile, and he was already in the news. So there were a lot of retrospectives for Stephen Sondheim, and it is sad to see him go. Who we also lost this past week, which got less news and got less coverage, but it's something that you know, kind of hit me a little bit hard. Eddie Mecca. He's best known for playing Carmine Ragusa in Laverne and Shirley, the big ragu. And I mean, he did other things outside of that. He was a big star in the 70s and 80s. But that's what he's most well known for. He passed away at age 69 in his home on November 27th. I was actually just thinking about him the other day, about the character he played and how it was so iconic. And as much as that can be a frustration to an actor to be known as the boyfriend of a character on a TV show, you got a measure of fame. And yeah, you may not be remembered 500 years in the future, but you had a fan base. You touched people's lives. So when you're looking at your own accomplishments, no matter how insignificant you feel they are, take pride in that and love the fact that there were people that responded to and positively appreciated your work. So it's also sad to see Eddie Mecca pass. The next piece of news is not really like topical news, but it's an article I saw, and I thought it was really interesting because I think it addresses something that we've been seeing going on in movies lately. And it's on Slash Film. It's written by Ben Pearson. And here's the title of it, if in case you want to look it up. It says, "Here's Why Movie Dialogue Has Gotten More Difficult to Understand and Three Ways to Fix It." Now, it's a long article, and I appreciate that, because a lot of times in film journalism, they just kind of poop out some short, you know, 200-word piece just to get the clickbait or the news out there. But this is actually a well-thought-out, researched piece where Pearson went and talked to industry professionals. He talked to people in the sound departments and sound editing and sound recordists and people who are working behind the scenes, both on set and in post. And to the point that there were some people who didn't want to go on record because they felt that it would endanger their careers if they were critical of how movies are made in such a way to make them, I guess you could say, look bad or sound bad. And he came up with several different points, and some of them are obvious. Like, for example, directors like Christopher Nolan want it that way. Nolan is well known for covering his dialogue with music and effects and other sounds and being like, oh, the dialogue's not important, even though it is. And there are also actors who like to mumble lines. They talk about it with the same thing with Christopher Nolan movies. You got Tom Hardy, who's well known for not speaking his lines very clearly. And there are other actors that do that. There's a lot of people that are into the mumbling of the lines, or they say it very softly. But I think the greater issue he brings up is the fact that the movie industry considers sound to be less important, or rather dialogue to be less important. When was the last time a movie won an Oscar for best sound that wasn't some big, explosive, massive piece? My Dinner with Andre was not going to be up for best sound. They don't care about the dialogue, because when you are in that theatrical experience, it's all about the loudness and the explosions and the mix and the stereo back and forth. And they kind of forget that people actually have to build characters and develop plots with dialogue. The other thing is, there's better technology that'll fix the stuff in post, even though you shouldn't. You shouldn't fix stuff in post. You should do it right the first time. But oftentimes, for budgetary reasons and scheduling reasons, they plow through this stuff. Also, when you're on film set, if you don't understand the dialogue, you hear the scene 50 times, so you will eventually know what the dialogue is. It doesn't matter how much somebody's mumbling it. But it's different when you're watching the movie for the first time and it goes by and you don't have a chance to rewind. And when you deal with theaters that mix their sound so they're so loud. I saw this with Dune when I saw it in the movie theater. The scenes were so loud and the ships were loud and the music was loud. And then people talk like this all the time, which is annoying. And then you finally got the end result where it's all going to streaming. It's that's where things are being immortalized. And there's only so much that a streaming service can do. And even if you have good quality standards like Netflix does, he points out in the article, they're one of the best in terms of quality standards for sound mix delivering. If you don't have a decent speakers on your TV or you don't have a good sound bar, I mean, you're limited by what the consumer has put together to watch. Then he gives all these suggestions on what can be done. And they're all basically like, make people understand that sound's more important. You're not going to get that. And also, because everybody's now immortalizing their stuff on streaming, and the options for subtitles are always there. I started watching subtitles on DVDs back when I had young children and I couldn't play the TV too loud and the sound mix was off. It was sometimes hard to hear the dialogue. I like having subtitles. I watched Tenet for the first time and I use subtitles. I am not ashamed to admit that. Nothing big happened with the box office, so we'll skip that and talk more about that next week, because I guarantee you not a whole lot's going to happen big with the box office this week. But let's move on. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first movie I want to talk about is Black Phone, which is coming to theaters on February 4th.
Would you like to see a magic trick?
I have an announcement to make. One of our students, Finney Blake, was abducted.
What if I could help the police find Finney?
Daddy, I had a dream about it.
What happened in your dream?
He was taken.
By a man with black balloons?
Yes.
We never released those details.
Please, please let the dreams be real.
This is done by Scott Derrickson, who, of course, did most famously Doctor Strange, but he did stuff like Sinister and The Exorcism of Emily Rose, even though I think that movie had serious problems with it. He's a great, creepy horror movie director. And this one is about this guy played by Ethan Hawke who abducts these children, and this kid is trying to escape, and there's this phone that allows him, at least the way the trailer plays it out, he's allowed to talk to the spirits of the past victims. This looks creepy as all get out. This looks like it's on the level of Sinister, which Scott Derrickson had done before, and I really thought that was a disturbing but effective horror movie. And that also had Ethan Hawke in it as well. So I'm looking forward to this one. I'm kind of excited. It'll be a good thing to see a movie that's not terrible in February. Next, I want to talk about the DC League of Super Pets, an animated film which is coming out in the summer, May 2022.
We'll go for a walk.
I have an owner, and he's Superman.
My dog's the best, but he's not the greatest with other animals.
What is new with you, fellow normal dog?
Well, well, well. If it isn't the Justice League...
Super strong.
I should be a lot more dead right now, right?
My best friend is in danger, and you have to help me.
Well, we're just a bunch of shelter pets.
But they're stronger than you think.
This one is an animated film about the pets of the superheroes. And, of course, it centers on Krypto, the dog that Superman owns. And, of course, Ace the Bat-Hound's in there. And those are real things from the comic books, by the way. Superman did have a dog named Krypto who had superpowers. And Batman did have, I think it was a German Shepherd named Ace the Bat-Hound. And you can find them actually in some of the cartoons. They haven't made their way into the movies yet, but now they're getting their own thing. And this looks fun. It's basically the Superman version of The Secret Life of Pets. So this looks like it'll be cute. I like Dwayne Johnson. I like Kevin Hart. It looks like they're going to have some good chemistry, not just on the screen, but in the booth. So I'm excited to see this one. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Wolf and Diary of a Wimpy Kid. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about some new films in the theaters. Just to let you know, there's not a lot of new big stuff this week. That's not uncommon in Hollywood when there's a big week of movies, which is usually on Thanksgiving. And last week we had Encanto and we had House of Gucci. And that's, of course, following up stuff like Ghostbusters. We had a very busy October. Usually after a big week, there's a week off where Hollywood gives those films a chance to burn out for another week before they start releasing bigger releases. So on the 10th, you're going to get some real big stuff. But right now, you're getting that post-Thanksgiving breather, and so they're releasing smaller films like this independent movie, Wolf. And I talked about this on the Trailer Park a couple months ago, but now I had a chance to see it. In Wolf, two young adults undergo controversial therapy to cure them from the feeling that they identify as wild animals.
Once there was a place in the woods where they sent people who didn't fit into the real world.
Welcome, Jacob.
Species identity disorder can be cured so that a person who thinks themselves an animal can resume a happy, healthy, and rewarding life.
I want to do it. It's the best thing for everyone.
End up wonderful human beings.
This reminds me a little bit of the movie The Lobster, the Yorgos Lanthimos movie. If you remember that, it had Joaquin Phoenix, where people would become animals, actually become animals. It was a science fiction-y kind of thing, but done in a very muted, pragmatic situation. This is not meant to be science fiction. It's meant to address like a real thing. I mean, there is a real condition where people identify with other species, and even then it's kind of considered fringe anyways, because it's not people identifying that they're a parrot. It's people actually identifying that they're elves or fantasy creatures or unicorn. And yes, animals do come in there. It's stuff like a wolf, which is a very spiritual animal. It finds its way into spiritual elements all over the place. So this is considered more metaphysical, as it's not a real condition that's, I think, fully studied yet. So, I mean, it's a leaping off point, but I really don't think, like, there's a character in this movie that thinks he's a squirrel. I don't think that that's the stuff that's going on. Really, what this movie is doing is it's an allegory for conversion therapy on the LGBT community. And that's pretty obvious when you watch it. That's how they're framing it. Because what the people are identifying and what the people are doing is somewhat benign, even though, you know, it might be a wolf that bites people, but that's like the worst that they're going to do. But it's parents that are concerned, and the guy who runs it is kind of overbearing and has very controversial or objectionable techniques. So the idea is there. It's just, it's so heavy-handed. I mean, it does not veil it very well at all. And that's one of the things that I always get annoyed with, is I love having layers and symbolism and stuff like that in a movie, and it's wonderful to just sort of deconstruct it. But when you have a movie that is nothing but that, and then you're just like, well, now this is just a puzzle, or a movie that is so thinly veiled that you're like, well, obviously this is what it is. This is obviously a tale about conversion therapy and not really trying to tell a pragmatic story of people who think they're wolves and dogs and parrots and squirrels. So that's a hoop to jump through. And there's also the acting. I mean, the guy who plays the main part is fine, but like Lily Rose Depp's in this movie, and she's awful. I mean, she is really an awful, awful actress. The only reason this girl has gotten any parts in any movies is because of her last name. She's Johnny Depp's daughter, and that's why she's in films. I mean, except for the crap that Kevin Smith puts out, but that's because she's good friends with his daughter. I mean, and his daughter's only in movies because she's his daughter. I mean, she has zero filmography or almost nothing outside of what her father's directing. So she's terrible in this movie. It's trying to be significant and it's trying to be artistic, but it's almost just like mimicking what an art film would be. It's using long shots and quietness and almost this almost subdued approach that feels like they're imitating a better filmmaker. And that's ultimately my big problem with this movie. I mean, there's a lot wrong with it, and plus nothing really happens in it, and it's boring. And while it has some good actors in it, not Lily Rose Depp, of course, it really does kind of suck.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next film, which is Diary of a Wimpy Kid. In this animated Disney Plus reboot, a boy must navigate the ins and outs of middle school life.
Tomorrow is the first day of middle school. Luckily, I'm not alone in this middle school thing. I've got my best friend, Rally.
Here's what you need to know. Watch where you sit on the first day of school. Don't use the bathroom on the second floor. And finally, don't get the cheese touch. Because if you do, you might as well be dead.
We're in middle school now. Don't you think it's time to start acting our age? I'm like permanently scarred from that night.
Look at these little nerds.
I think it was about 10, 11 years ago, 20th Century Fox did an adaptation of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid book. And for those of you who aren't a parent, you have no idea what this is. I mean, you may have heard about the movies, but there are these books written by this guy named Jeff Kinney, and he's got like a dozen of them or more out there. And they're very, very popular with that grade school, middle school crowd. And they're fun books. I've read a couple of them because my kids were really into them when they were younger. I mean, now they're all too, I mean, my oldest are in there, you know, they're 18 and 20, and my youngest is only 13. And so he kind of left those behind. This is really more for grade school kids who are looking to start middle school. So they did a live action version and they did a couple sequels, and then they tried to reboot it a couple years ago, and that kind of flopped. And now that Disney owns the properties and the stuff that Fox had done, and it's no longer Fox, it's 20th Century Studios, they're doing the Diary of a Wimpy Kid movie. And so this one is CGI, so it's not live action. And in doing that, they animate the characters to look very much like the way they're drawn in the books, because the book is like handwritten, and then the kid draws pictures of what goes on, and it's these rudimentary stick figure drawings, and that's the look of the book. And so it really preserves that. And ultimately, it's bringing to life the first book, which was done in the Diary of a Wimpy Kid movie about a decade ago. So if you've seen that, you're treading familiar ground, but that's okay, because, you know, it's been 10 years. You can remake the movie. But the movie itself is only about an hour long. It's on Disney Plus, and it's good. I mean, it works because it's an authentic version of the movie, and I think it conceptualizes the story. And the story is it's a somewhat irreverent but very realistic view of what a kid would be thinking and going through as they're going into middle school, because that's a daunting time and that's scary. And you're no longer in grade school, and nobody wants to look like they're in grade school. And so it's this kid who belly aches and worries about it and ends up getting into worse situations because of his worries and problems. So I think it's good. It's well, not for me. It's made for kids. And if you're a fan of the books, you'll enjoy it. They're supposed to be making more of these. So I wouldn't be surprised if every 6 months or so we get another one of these movies. Like I said, they're an hour long and it has better animation than like a TV series. A lot of times those TV series look very canned if they have like 10 or 12 episodes a year. This one, you know, you got an hour long movie and they're not releasing it in theaters, partly because it's an hour and it builds up the Disney Plus content. So I thought it was cute. I'm going to say it kind of rocks because my kids were fans of the books and I read it, and I think, you know, it's what it needs to be for a Diary of a Wimpy Kid flashback.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about 8-Bit Christmas and Come On, Come On. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about 8-Bit Christmas. This actually came out at Thanksgiving, on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. I didn't get a chance to talk about it, but let's talk about it now. A father tells his daughter the story of how he and his friends attempted to get a Nintendo Entertainment System in the late 1980s.
Every kid has that one gift they want more than anything for Christmas. This is the story of mine, Nintendo. I needed a Christmas miracle.
The year was the late 80s. I was 11 years old.
Did you wear a helmet?
Yeah, we always wore helmets in the 80s.
Me and my friends would do anything just to play one.
I needed to get my own.
This is our Vietnam.
I don't think that means what you think it means.
For somebody like me who grew up in the 70s and 80s, a movie like this is easy because I've got all the nostalgia as a kid. I loved the 80s. I remember what it was like having video game systems. I remember when video game systems started. I mean, kids nowadays, like my kids, home video game systems always existed to them. It's like telephones in the house. I remember when these things first started. I remember the hubbub when Nintendo did come out, and it just blew stuff like Atari's gaming systems away. And it was such a big deal in the late 80s. Now, I was a little bit older than the characters in this movie. I mean, the kids were like 13 in 1988 is, I think, when this movie, they say the late 80s, but I think it's 1988 or so. So I was like 17 then. So I was a little bit older and I wasn't in that middle school age. But that's sort of that sweet spot because you're not a grade school kid where you're just thinking about toys, but you're also not a high school kid. And so there's still the play aspect of it and the fun that's associated with video games. Now, what this movie tends to be is it tends to be a mix between three different films. One of them is Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which I just talked about, because it deals with the trappings of middle school and dealing with awkwardness and the craziness of middle school and the growing up and that early adolescence where everybody's awkward and different people grow at different rates. So it captures that, but it's also obviously similar to A Christmas Story, which of course is about Ralphie wanting the Red Ryder BB gun. And it's that unattainable present that he wants for Christmas. And in this one, it's a Nintendo Entertainment System because his parents don't believe in him. Oh, no, it's going to rot your brain. And I remember my parents would say stupid things like that when I was a kid. Oh, you shouldn't watch too much TV. It'll mush your mind. And I'm like, and look what I grew up to be. I watch TV and movies for a living. So, ha-ha, my mind's as sharp as a that pointy thing that you stick in the wall. Anyways, so this captures that essence of parents who never grew up with this. Now, it's funny because you got Steve Zahn as the father and June Diane Raphael as the mother, and they do a great job. Weirdly enough, Steve Zahn played the dad in the Diary of a Wimpy Kid original movie. But it also is a bit of Jingle All the Way in there, of all movies. But Jingle All the Way, it's the shopping experience that shows that movie, where the kids have hatched this elaborate plan to try and get one from the mall, but at the same time, these community leaders were railing against video games and saying how bad they were and they wanted to ban them, which really happened. I mean, people still, they warp back around to that all the time. Anytime there's a violent event, like a mass shooting or something like that, everyone always warps back to video games. Video games are the culprits. It's not video games, it's the people. And so this does capture that do-gooder mentality, you know, and this was really big in the 80s, and it spilled over into the 90s. And, you know, a lot of people like to think, put a political spin on it, and it's on both sides, really. But you got to remember, Tipper Gore was going after rap music back in the 90s. So this is something that, from a kid's perspective, politics doesn't matter. And that's the other thing it encapsulates. It has all this sort of adult political stuff going on behind the scenes, but it's, the kids don't care about it and they're unaffected by it because they don't care about politics. They care about their NES. And it's a fun movie and it's not perfect. It does not land on everything. There are some things that it misses the mark. And at times it does kind of swerve away from the MacGuffin of trying to get the NES and they're dealing with him and his family and appreciating Christmas and friends and that sort of thing. But it's still a fun movie. I enjoyed it. It to me, it could be a holiday tradition. I don't know if it's going to live, but it very well could be. Who knows? It might just be for people in my generation who grew up in the 80s and can remember this stuff. But anyways, I'm going to say 8-Bit Christmas rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Come On, Come On. A radio interviewer ends up taking care of his behaviorally challenged nephew and develops a special bond.
To visit planet Earth, you will have to be born as a human child.
Are you a hook?
At first, you will have to learn to use your new body. To move your arms and legs, you will learn to walk and run, to use your hands, to make sounds, and form words. There will be so much for you to learn, and so much for you to feel.
Joaquin Phoenix plays, and I think he works for NPR or something like that, but he basically plays a guy who's interviewing kids around the country just about being kids and what it's like, you know, on the verge of adulthood and not being listened to by adults. And so it has him going around and just interviewing people all around the country. And he ends up connecting with his sister, who they've had an estranged relationship. She's played by Gabby Hoffman. And she's got a son who has some behavioral issues. And his father, they're separated, but there's still an affinity there. But the reason they're separated is because the father is dealing with some mental illness. And he spirals and he needs help. And so she is pulled away to try and help this guy. But you can see the seeds of I'm not going to say mental illness in the child, but difficulties that could blossom into mental illness if they are not addressed properly at a young enough age. My apologies to anybody if I oversimplified that. It's very down to earth. It's very pragmatic. It's shot in black and white, which that's like a trend now. This is honestly like the fifth movie I've seen this season. I mean, I'm not talking about this year, but this season. That's in black and white. You know, Belfast was in black and white. Macbeth, the one that's coming out at the end of the month, that's in black and white. And look, I get it. That's an aesthetic. But at this point, it's turning into a gimmick. I mean, black and white's fun, but, you know, it's like the people like, I like black and white photography because it gives you a better look into the soul. You know, shut up. Photography, use the range of colors. It doesn't need to be in black and white, but they do it, so it kind of has that postcard look to it. But ultimately, the core of the film is this relationship between this guy who doesn't have kids, and he has some trauma in his past, but he doesn't like talking about his personal life, and he's dealing with his sister's son, and she kind of drops him in his lap, and good for him to step up and help. But here's the problem with this movie is twofold. First of all, they're the hippy-dippy parents. You know, they're the ones who are like, oh, you never raise your voice at a child because it scares them. There's a scene where they're in New York. They're in some Stop and Rob on the corner, and the kid hides from him. And when he finally finds him because he's freaked out, the kid's like, ha-ha, got you. And he yelled at the kid. And then the next scene is him apologizing to the kid and apologizing to his mother and saying, oh, my gosh, I'm so sorry that I yelled. I shouldn't have done it. It's like, no, there are times where it's 100% appropriate to yell at a child. If you need to make them stop, do something, or if they just need to know what they did is wrong. Maybe this kid's behavioral issues are because you're such a goofy parent that you don't know how to deal with a child. And that's ultimately the problem I had with this movie is when I see just plain old bad parenting, where the people can't control themselves or their own issues, and they make terrible decisions for dumb reasons. I've raised three kids. Well, my one's 13, so he's not fully raised yet. But we're on the way. And I got very well-balanced, good, solid, balanced kids. And you have your ups and downs as a parent. But when you treat them like they get to rule the house, you know, and when I see bad parenting in a movie, it irritates me. And then I don't like it. And ultimately, that made me hate all the characters. I didn't like this kid because the kid's a pain in the keister. Unnecessarily. The mom is a nutcase on her own, but she's just not as much of a nutcase as the father, who's spiraling out of control, borderlining on schizophrenia. And then she just drops him in the hands of somebody who has zero experience with this. And then, of course, he has to. And I don't know. This annoyed me. That's the problem. I appreciate the effort. And, you know, they did a good job making the movie, but I just hated the character so much. I couldn't wait for it to end. So I'm going to say, come on, sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Silent Night and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Malignant. To Feck Eyes at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up with some more movie reviews and talk about Silent Night. A group of family and friends gather for a final holiday against the backdrop of a global cataclysm.
Here's to the lives that we've shared. To our beautiful children. Our beautiful friends. May we rest in peace.
We know the Russians want us all dead. They're sending poisonous gas to kill us all in the morning.
It's not the Russians, it's the planet.
It will kill anything and anyone that is still alive.
We just want to make sure that you understand that as your parents,
We are not to blame.
I have heard this described as an anti-Christmas movie, and I think that's fair. I mean, it's not as much as these, every now and then around February, you get these anti-Valentine's Day movies where, you know, somebody has been wrong, so they have to vent their spleen on the rest of the world who want to be happy. This is also not trying to villainize Christmas. So when I say an anti-Christmas movie, it's not like Krampus, which is sort of this anti-hero of a movie. And this is more what you would think would be a Christmas movie, but it's not at the most wonderful time of the year at all. And it starts off without knowing what goes on. I mean, it's weird because to understand what the movie's about, you have to engage in a certain degree of spoilers. And the best I'll say, and as I described in the blurb, there's a global cataclysm that's happening that's going to like be disastrous. You know, this seems to be a popular thing. Now, this comes around every 10 years, you know, a movie about the end of the world. We'll talk more about this when Don't Look Up comes out. But, you know, about 10 years ago, we got a bunch of end of the world movies and now we got a bunch of them. And that's kind of what this is. But the whole thing is it starts out with this family and friends coming for just a wonderful dinner, and they're all gathering, and it's meant to be a wonderful time for them. And then, you know, as we roll into the second act, we start to understand what's actually going on. And what's funny about this one is it kind of reminds me a little bit of my response to Come On, Come On, in that I didn't like the characters. It's very, very difficult to root for characters you don't like, unless they're lovably unlikable, or they're such misfits and they have problems, but they're fun to watch. I like to use the movie Boogie Nights as a great example of characters that really may not be great people, but they're very well written and they're fun to watch. Or like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. They're horrible people, but their antics are funny. But that's a thin line, and that usually is reserved for either broad comedies or very special stories. Something like this, the problem is none of the people are likable in the movie. And yeah, I mean, not to say you're wishing global cataclysm on everybody, and certainly if it's a global cataclysm, all the good people are going to get wiped out along with the bad people. But this one, the people are just so nasty to each other and so vapid and shallow. And I mean, that's kind of part of the joke is even, you know, in the face of something horrible that's going to be coming very, very soon, they're still worried about stuff they really shouldn't be worried about. And one of the things I always say in a movie is, especially if it's something like this where people are gathering together, if I don't want to spend the time with these people, it makes it a very hard sell, because even though there's some humor to it and there's some characters that are slightly better than others, but they're all really just awful people. There's one kid in there and he's okay, but the kid's kind of a mess anyways. I just didn't like the characters. And while I can appreciate what they're trying to do, and I can appreciate them doing this sort of anti-Christmas movie, and it is well acted. I mean, it's actually got a good cast. You've got Keira Knightley and Matthew Good and Lucy Punch. And you've got the little kid from Jojo Rabbit, the main kid from Jojo Rabbit. His name escapes me. But, I mean, you've got other people in this movie, and I've recognized them, and they do a wonderful job portraying these awful characters. It's the best way I could put it. So I just, a movie like this, even though you can laugh at the people's acerbic nature, you have to like the characters. You have to feel for the characters, or the essence of it, the humanity and the pathos you would feel, doesn't exist. And that was the problem, is I didn't care what happened. When a movie's about people living or dying and you don't care whether the people live or die, it makes it very hard to watch. So I'm going to have to say this one kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on the movie Malignant, which came out on DVD and Blu-ray this week. James Wan directs this tribute to Italian giallo horror films and 80s cinema about murders that a woman witnesses in her dreams.
The body of Dr. Florence Weaver was found brutally murdered in her home this morning.
Did you know her?
No. But I saw her die.
I'm seeing things. I'm seeing murders. As they're happening.
He says his name is Gabriel.
I think he's someone from my past.
He's the devil.
I remember when this came out, I think it was in September, and it just kind of blipped on the radar in terms of the theatrical run, but it got a lot of attention because it dropped on HBO Max, because it was a theatrical release in 2021, so they dropped it on HBO Max for 30 days. And I knew a lot of people who watched it, and people loved it. What's so interesting about this movie, and I love James Wan's horror stuff anyway, so I was excited to see this, is the movie starts off, and it just seems like sort of like a rote, boring movie, but as it develops, and they start figuring out what's going on, and you start understanding the elements to it and what's happening and, you know, surprises and, you know, spoilers and stuff. But boy, by the time you get to the third act, you're reeling because there's so many insane things that happen and it makes it so wildly fun and entertaining. That's what I loved about this movie. It was a hoot to watch and it was exciting and it was original, but it was also a homage to things, like I said, Italian giallo horror. It certainly has that element to it in the violence and the personal violence that happens in there. But it's also a homage to sort of the gooey goopy special effects, practical effects elements from the 80s. I mean, stuff that would not have gotten a mainstream release. It would be, there were a lot of these movies, especially back in the 80s, that were from smaller production houses and they do limited runs and they wouldn't be as widespread or as big on the box office as something like Star Wars in the 80s, but they still got theatrical release. A lot of that stuff has moved to VOD and direct streaming for horror films. And so you get a lot of this stuff in horror films, but that's kind of flying under the radar right now in terms of the mainstream. So when they released something like Malignant to the mainstream didn't know what to do with it. And it got the kind of a polarizing response from the people who watched the movie either on HBO Max or in the theaters who were not knowing what to get. And it was weird because you had two different reactions. For somebody like me who has a history of watching horror movies and understanding horror and understanding their place and development in cinema, it started out as somewhat mundane and it just got crazier and crazier. And that made me love it even more. And then I think your average person saw it and think, oh, this is just going to be a haunted house movie. And then it just starts going off the rails and they didn't know what to make of it. Now, what's interesting is in going back and rewatching it, I don't know if it needed the big action set pieces it has, because it has about three or four very elaborate camera tracking action and violent set pieces. And while they're fun to watch, it's almost too big for a movie like this. This is the kind of movie that you would have seen in grindhouse cinemas in the 70s or 80s. I could name some, but unfortunately by naming the movies that it reminds me of, it's a big spoiler. So I really enjoyed this. I actually kind of, in fact, if I were to say that my drawbacks on this are it's almost too big. It's almost too high of a production value. I wanted to see something a little grittier. And that's would have made it work, but it's still a hoot of a movie. It's great fun. It's very different. It's unique in terms of modern horror cinemas. And it shows that James Wan was trying to do something different, which is great. Cause I should go back and watch his movie Dead Silence because, you know, he has such a history with horror, developing the Saw movies and Conjuring and Insidious. And then I watched the Blu-ray. Unfortunately, the Blu-ray only has like a 15-minute behind-the-scenes feature, which is unfortunate because there's a lot of cool stuff going on in this movie, and just 15 minutes, it crams it in there. But I'll tell you, do not watch the 15-minute behind-the-scenes feature until you've seen the movie. Even just, I mean, seriously, like watching the beginning of it, you will spoil everything in the film. Best watch this movie clean, not knowing anything about it, and let it evolve and turn into something insane, rather than watch that 15-minute special feature and know everything that's going to happen. But still, I'm going to say, I had a hoot watching this movie and it was fun to revisit, so I'm going to have to say that Malignant totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Also available this week, we have Saint Maud, Blood for Dracula in 4K, Heaven Can Wait, Downton Abbey, the complete series, and I Dream of Jeannie, the complete series. And that's it for this week. I need to go. Next week when I come back, I'm going to be talking about West Side Story, Don't Look Up, and Being the Ricardos. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.